From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Thursday, October 10th, and I'm your host for today, Andy Klein, filling in for Boston Christopher, who's up in Anchorage doing a play. Gunashish. Thanks for joining the conversation. And on today's show, a new regular segment we're doing with Tlingit and Haida. Today, we'll be talking about Alaska Native eligibility under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. We'll unwrap that a little bit. The Capital City Fire and Rescue and Bartlett Regional Hospital are going to be here. They're teaming up to work on Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Juno Nordic Ski Team is starting up. We'll talk to coaches and students. And the Forest Service monthly check-in. We'll be touching on a new dedication for an Amos Wallace carved totem at the Mendenhall Visitor Center and the U.S. Capitol Christmas tree that comes from the Tongass this year. Those conversations are coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years. With cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
And KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Kliné have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands and now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds, and to gatherings in other villages, and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations.
Hansen Gress, Ka eat with the Shu Yi, we Kashuk a ye tin. Jin kat ka ke jin talk, anachaya ha anikach, gunish cheese.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. You're listening from Studio 2K. And I'm your host for today, Andy Klein. We have a really excellent and interesting and regional conversation happening right now. This is with folks from the Tlingit and Haida. And it's all about Alaska Native eligibility under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. This is going to be a regular feature here on Juno Afternoon. And joining me in the studio is Jackie Peta. Jackie, thanks so much for coming in and joining me today. I appreciate having you here.
Thank you.
Yeah. And joining us via Zoom is Ralph Wolf. And Ralph's joining us from Sitka. Hello, Ralph. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Great to have you here. And Heather Duville, who's here, and she's joining us from Prince of Wales Island in Craig. And Heather, how are you?
Hi, good afternoon. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Well, let's unwrap this a little bit, and I'll throw it out open to the floor. Whoever maybe wants to take this, you, the Tlingit and Haida, had a sort of a tribal consultation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in September. And that consultation centered around, maybe among other things, but centered around the Marine Mammal Protection Act and how that impacts people here in Southeast Alaska, natives here in Southeast Alaska. So, Jackie, since you're here in the room with me, I'll throw it to you first.
Sure.
Tell me a little bit about that meeting, what happened, and what did you start talking about there?
Great. And I'll give you a little bit of background first. And then, of course, Ralph's going to give you all the technical answers.
Okay.
All right. So, you know, for years, this has been an issue for the Tlingit and Haida delegates as we come together at each one of our annual meetings. We have had numerous resolutions being passed to try to address this blood quantum issue, which was not a statutory requirement, but was a requirement in the way the law was being implemented by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And so it required that you had to have a quarter blood quantum to be able to hunt the sea otters, you know, the northern sea otters.
And does it also apply to seals and things like that as well, or is it mostly centered on the otters?
This part of it was centered on the otters, and you know, Ralph can speak more to the other things, but this particular harvesting of the otters was the issue at stake. And we've had consultations and discussions with them because this wasn't statutory. And we even met with our congressional delegation, you know, congressional session after congressional session. And it wasn't just Central Council, it was Sea Alaska and number of other tribes in the region and organizations in the region who have band together to say, this is an issue. We want to be able to make sure that we can have the recognition as our tribal descendancy is of just lineal descendants rather than having this federal
fairly arbitrary.
Blood quantum issue. Yeah. But also it was difficult because as we deal with our, you know, marine mammal responsibilities for monitoring and for harvesting and balance of the ecosystems, we are starting to see in Southeast Alaska the challenges of an expanding, sea otter population and what it's doing to our subsistence lifestyle. But more than that, it also was starting to say, who's good enough? Is your blood quantum enough? And my grandchildren, for example, couldn't go harvest. And so I couldn't teach them the things that I needed to pass down from one generation to another. And so the loss of culture and also the responsibility for making sure that we keep our natural resources in balance were both getting skewed. Mm. So we are very grateful. This administration said that this was going to be a priority. They felt that they found a solution. They called this consultation. We were all in the room. Ralph was there. I was there. We were all there in the room. President Peterson was there. And as we gave our impassioned speeches about why we wanted them to do something, they responded with this new guidance. And we were just very, very pleased. And now we're just working at the implementation portions of it. So I'm going to push it now to Ralph.
Okay, Ralph. Well, so this new guidance, tell me a little bit about what that contains. And then, Heather, I want to talk to you about how it affects you. And I know you're someone who's obviously on the front lines of harvesting and gathering and doing all this traditional gathering of sea mammals and of marine mammals. But yeah, Ralph, let's talk to you a little bit about what are some of the specifics that that stood out to you in the new guidelines.
One of the important things is there was no regulatory changes that happened in the consultation, but I think there was some letters, a letter that was given to us from the Department of Interior with a recognition and clarification that there's an or in the regulations there. It's not just one quarter blood quantum. It's one quarter blood quantum or, in the absence of that, a citizen who is regarded as Alaska Native by the native village or town, which the hunter claims to be from. So as a tribal organization, that proves that we live on this coastline and we are Tlingit and Haida of this region, we feel like that was enough. And that was the lineal descent aspect that we were really looking for. And I think it's very important for us at the tribe to show that, because I think, as Vice President Pato was saying, you know, for a long time, is it enough? Are we enough? Like, we've been divisive enough with each other. And this has been a very divisive topic around the state of Alaska, right? Like, I think there's some folks up north who wouldn't like to see that blood quantum removed. But as a region, we feel like we're losing a lot of culture behind that blood quantum. And I think this is a way for us to provide, one, avenues for children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews now, whose grandparents had done this for generations, to be able to be allowed to do this, like Jackie's grandkids, like Heather's nieces and nephew. Through the consultation, like, I think there was a lot of back and forth on when this announcement was made to us, is that enough? And it can go either way, because there was no changes made. And I feel like in the room, it was almost a letdown. But with that or in there, that gave us everything that we needed to move forward and put out this press release saying that, as we understand it through the interpretation from the Department of Interior, you're allowed to be Native enough. And I think that's the emphasis that we're putting out there.
Heather, from your perspective as someone who's doing this kind of activity every day, and I should mention, does an amazing job of showing what that lifestyle is like and teaching parts of that lifestyle through your social media channels. What did this new clarification mean for you?
So when I found out that the announcement was going to be made, I actually got emotional, because this is very near and dear to me. As I understood it previously, my niece and nephew couldn't engage in this cultural harvesting or working with furs. They couldn't come over and help, you know, me stretch furs, cut furs, or learn how to sew. So I was really happy to learn about this clarification. And also, it's just really important to me to be able to pass down this cultural tradition and knowledge to the next generation. I dedicate a lot of my time in the winter to harvesting sea otters and working with their pelts. And I just want to be able to teach and be a resource for anyone who has any questions on how to prepare for harvesting. You know, you make sure you have your tribal ID, but also if there's any questions about skinning, fleshing, how to process the furs, it is very time consuming. There is a learning curve to it. It's a little bit different than other animals where their fur is so dense that they don't cool down as quickly. So you need to be able to have the time and pay, you know, give that attention to them quickly after harvesting. So,
yeah, I was just going to say, being a fan of your page and being a fan of your social media myself and seeing it, I could just imagine that it would be a tragic almost if you couldn't share that as your father has shared with you and as you demonstrate on your social media sites, the amazing wealth of knowledge that he has and is continually passing on to you. For you not to be able to pass that on to a next generation would feel like a real loss, I would think.
It would. And as Jackie mentioned, you know, to her grandkids, and that's one of the beauties of technology these days is we can reach people throughout the whole region quickly through social media, video, you know, YouTube. We can help each other answer questions, and we're all connected closely, even though we're separated by distance, you know, throughout Southeast Alaska. We can still connect and be able to support each other in that way. And that's one thing that I really value when it comes to social media and being able to be available to our people and help them throughout the process.
Well, is there Yeah, absolutely. Is there something that tribal citizens should know about preparing for the harvest for sea otters now that this clarification has been brought forward by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service?
I think most important is we want to make sure that people are carrying their tribal ID with them. You know, the law does require that you're a member of a coastal tribe. Klinken Haida has a coastal tribe. And so making sure that they have their tribal ID is going to be important to do that. And then, of course, knowing exactly what to do, as Heather said, making sure that people are using respectfully the resource.
You don't want to waste.
I think those are things that we teach. You know, when I was listening to Heather, a couple of really good examples of how this has harmed us a little bit in the past is we'd be teaching moccasin making classes or other things, whether it be SHI or Gobalt Heritage or whoever was teaching. We would be able to say, okay, you can use this fur, but you can't use this fur because depending upon whether they had the blood quantum or not. And we would make them bring their CDIB, their certificate of blood, to the classes so that we could let them use sea otter. An example I shared at the consultation was we're preparing for our Kuik, our memorial potlatch for our clan. And we wanted to make our guests sea otter keychains. And I realized at the clan meeting that I was trying to pass out the square so people could help us. And I realized I didn't do that because I didn't want any of our clan members to feel like they were not enough because they didn't meet the blood quantum mm-hmm. to sew the sea otter. Now we can all do it together. So that's a joyous part of this. So just really making sure that you know what you're doing and you're prepared. I think Heather really said it right on when this is a lot of work. And our ancestors, my elders taught me, you start and you finish. You don't get halfway through and tired. You have to start and finish, and you have to finish right, respectfully, with the harvest.
Ralph, does this ruling sort of provide a bit of a precedent that may be applied in other areas?
I think so. I think there's ways that, you know, the tribe is moving towards co-management in different aspects of resources around our region, right? You know, the first lots of questions we've been getting around, does this pertain to seals and sea lions? And we had a meeting with NOAA this morning, and, you know, their answer wasn't yes or no, but they're totally aligned with Fish and Wildlife Services and how they interpret and aligned with the existing regulation. So I think it's a doorway, but I don't think we're necessarily looking to swing the doors wide open, right? I think we're looking for opportunities to help our agency folks out. We're looking at opportunities to, you know, one of the things with sea otters in the region is resource management. I think if you look at traditional harvested seafoods around the region, you're seeing a huge devastation to the populations of clams and cockles and sea urchins and abalone, to where you can't get them around local communities anymore. You've got to travel further to get them, and the resource is becoming very depleted. So one of the aspects that we're really looking at under working forward with co-management is kind of like seeing how the assessments are being done, how we can help, seeing how as people who live with the resources around us, how we can help try to bring those back to a time where we could go and get a bucket of clams in an hour or less. Right now, it's like you go out for a whole tide and you can't get a bucket of clams. You can't find abalone in certain areas. Now they're eating crabs and urchin. And you just see all of these things happening. And I think, you know, we're really looking at this resource management aspect of it so that we can continue eating our traditional foods as we go forward.
Well, getting back to the sea otters, Heather, can you give us a little bit more details about the really intricate preparation and harvesting procedures that you need to follow when you're kind of correctly harvesting a sea otter? It seems like a very specialized animal to harvest.
I think personally, I like Jackie had mentioned, you know, we want to honor those who came before us and follow our traditional values. So, I mean, personally, I practice, for me, it ethically hunting. So I don't hunt moms with pups. I go after singles. That's what we call them, single sea otters. And you want to make sure you're safe, of course. Make sure you have the appropriate safety equipment. They're hard to hunt. They're hard to get. So there's a learning curve. It takes practice.
Are you in a boat or do you get to the... Tell me about that.
Most of the time you're shooting off a boat, so you're moving with the swell, right, and they're moving swell at a different rate. And sometimes you can get off on a rock, but it's pretty rare that that happens and you can be successful because they know you're there and they're getting out of there. But I would also recommend knowing who your taggers are in your community, because they do require you to get a tag placed on the pelts. And then you also need your tribal ID to register to tan pelts. So those are good tips to get established ahead of time before you harvest, so you can get your tagger lined up and tagged timely so your pelt doesn't spoil. They can be kept in the freezer for an extended period of time before fleshing them and preparing them for the tannery. So that's a good option to have some freezer space and just make sure you honor your values and have respect and make sure you take good care of the things that you harvest and that you use all of them.
If there are people out there that are interested in this and qualify to be able to do this, but haven't had the teachings, I'm sure you're offering resources. I'm wondering how they can get resources.
I would say, don't be afraid to ask an elder, ask even on social media, send us an email, a text. Like, we're always happy to help. I'm so grateful for the people who have spent, you know, taken the time to teach me. And that's part of our culture, is generously sharing knowledge. And reach out to me. I'm happy to help with any questions that you have. I love to teach. This is one of my passions, is skin sewing, and especially working with sea otter furs. So I am so excited for this clarification and change. It's going to open the door for us to provide a lot of education throughout the entire region. And I am so ready for that.
Well, thanks to all three of you for just the beginning of the discussion of this. And as we said at the top of this, this is a regular feature on Juno Afternoon to talk to Klingit and Haida and talk about the issues that are at hand. So I'm sure we'll be talking to all of you again about this issue and other issues. Ralph Wolf, the Tlingit and Haida Director of Indigenous Stewardship Program. Thank you so much, Ralph. I appreciate you joining today mm-hmm. from Sitka. And Heather Duville, who's Tlingit and Haida Regional Resources Coordinator, and she's down in Craig on Prince of Wales Island. And as I said, AK Moosey, do I have this? Is that right?
Yeah.
AK Moosey is her handle on Instagram. I'm telling you, people, go check it out. It is so cool and amazing. And her dad's a rock star. So thanks so much for joining. Great to meet you in person, Heather. And Jackie Peta is here in person with us. She's with Tlingit and Haida. She's first vice president. And Jackie, thanks so much for kind of giving us the overview of this discussion. And we look forward to talking to you about another issue involving Tlingit and Haida as we do this as a regular feature on Juneau Afternoon. Thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andy.
Okay.
I'll finish too.
Welcome back. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon. What you're listening to right there is George Kuhar is going to be part of the 20th, 40th, 50th anniversary fest that's happening coming up this weekend. George and a bunch of other great musicians will be playing. You'll hear more about that in just a little bit. But joining me right now is Sadie Inman, and Sadie is here from the Capital City Fire and Rescue Union. Tell me the name of the union. Did I have it right?
It is the International Association of Firefighters.
International Association of Firefighters Union. You're with Capital City Fire and Rescue, and you're partnering up, or the union is partnering up with Bartlett to bring awareness to Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
Yes.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the month. What's some of the things that are happening?
So this is the third year that we've partnered with Bartlett. We're hoping to continue the partnership. You will see our Bartlett Regional Diagnostic Imaging Team and the firefighters around Juneau wearing our pink t-shirts just to raise awareness. But the main message that I'm on here to give is the same one that every Bartlett employee has had coming on here, which is get your mammogram. Preventative medicine is the best medicine. And just to add a little bit of statistics to it. So 1 in 8 women will develop breast cancer in her life. So
it's so. Who hasn't had a family member, a person in their life have to deal with this issue at some point? It's so important, as you say. I think not just get your mammogram, but get that schedule going, right?
Yes.
Get that, have that just be a part of your what you do.
People
I'm sure
say,
it's not the most exciting, pleasant thing to get done, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's just one of these things that you have to kind of take care of to make sure that you're good and healthy.
Mm-hmm. People say you should treat it like the dentist. It's just as important to go get your mammogram as it is to go to the dentist every
yes,
day.
Yes, absolutely. That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, tell me a little bit about why you think the union is in a specific, position to want to partner with on this Awareness Month.
So it's not just our local union here. The international has all the different locals partner with hospitals, raise awareness, raise money. And it's something that hits especially close to home for firefighters because of our increased risk for cancer. We have a 9% higher risk of being diagnosed with cancer and a 14% higher risk of dying from cancer.
Now, is that because of exposure to different elements when you're on site on fires, things like that?
It has a couple different factors, but yes, exposures on fires that can seep through our skin, lack of sleep and
stress.
Regular cortisol dumps mm-hmm. really keep us from being able to reduce the inflammation that contributes to cancer. And recently they found out that our gear that we wear into fires is actually full of PFAS, which is the forever chemicals. So there's ongoing legislation around
that.
Oh,
my goodness. Yeah. And the minute you said that, it totally makes sense because fire suppression is such a part of those chemicals.
Yeah.
And I think we're seen as miracle chemicals, right?
Yes.
When they first came out
and
saved lives, I'm sure, saved
yes.
many, many lives, but at the same time had these other residual things happen. So tell me a little bit about some of the festivities, some of the things, what's going on this month, or is it just more about making sure people are really aware?
It is mostly based around awareness. Bartlett is really the center for all of those things. They have the state-of-the-art mammography. technology and everything. And they're coming on the radio regularly just to get the message out. So that is the main part of this month.
Yeah, yeah. And I know that they've actually increased their capabilities and the use of the equipment they use for, yes, during mammograms. It's, you know, they're becoming really sort of that cutting edge, state of the art,
yep,
facility.
It is new this year that Bartlett can now report breast density and perform contrast. So they are able to catch cancers at an even earlier stage starting this year. So it's completely new.
How did you get into firefighting?
I started as a volunteer.
Uh-huh.
That's the usual story here in Juneau.
And at Juneau or Douglas or?
So we're all one department now.
Oh, okay. Yep. I see. Okay. All right. But you still battle it out on the 4th of July.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
That's not going away. Well, cool. Yeah. So you started as a volunteer how many years ago? Or
I started as a volunteer in 2019 and I got hired in 2021.
And what's the process between going from volunteer to being a pro?
Well, a pro is a big word.
Well, you're paid.
Yes, that's, yes, true. A professional.
That's all true. I'm counting.
You have to take a couple classes. So the department puts on an EMT class and a Firefighter One Academy. So you get those things. And then there's a hiring process. And yeah, it can take some time. Right now, there is a shortage of firefighters nationwide. So if you are thinking about getting into firefighting, now is a great time. And you can inquire on the city website about that.
Cool. I'll just ask one more question about firefighting. Yep. What are the things about it that kind of attract you to it, that you like about it the most? And what are maybe some things that people, when you think of a firefighter, you wouldn't think that's part of the job?
Well, most of the firefighting that we do in Juneau is medicine. So we do EMS more than anything else. But my favorite parts of firefighting are the team aspect. You get so close with these people, you learn to work with them in all different sorts of situations. And it's just a community that I don't think you can find anywhere else.
When you say EMS, you mean that, why is it that you're not responding to fires necessarily, you're responding to medical emergencies?
Yep. So we have ambulances and fire trucks. Our ambulances respond to fires as well. But most of the time we get around 12 structural fires a year, but we run about 5,000 EMS calls a year.
Yeah, cool.
So,
okay, well, I've grilled you enough. Yes. Now back to the Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Let's just do a recap on it. Yep. So people kind of know and hear the message one more time.
So get your mammogram. Regular screening reduces your mortality rate by 26%. It's very significant. You can get your mammogram through Bartlett Regional Hospital. You don't have to get a referral. You can just call them at their number, 907-796-8802.
Great. Well, Sadie Inman with Juneau's Capital City Fire and Rescue, thanks so much.
Thank you so
much. And as you say, for everyone out there who's listening that hasn't made their mammogram appointment, do it. Appointment. Make it part of your daily, your yearly schedule, just like a dentist appointment.
Yes.
Thanks so much, Sadie. Appreciate
Thank you very
it.
Much.
Great to meet you. Yeah. And welcome back to Juneau Afternoon from Studio 2K here at KTOO. I'm your host for today, Andy Klein, and it's the Nordic Ski Team here. And Abby McAllister is here. You're the head coach.
I am. Yeah. Thanks so much
Nordic
for having
ski
us.
Team. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's very cool that you've got it going. And Zoe and Finn are with us as well. Thanks to both of you for coming. Tell me what we need to know about what's going on with Nordic Ski Team. It's starting up.
It is. So we just had registration open on October 2nd for all of our Nordic programs. So we have three different programs within the Nordic community here. It's all under the umbrella of the Juneau Nordic Ski Club. And so we have a high school team, which we're very excited to say that we're in our first full year as a sanctioned high school sport in the Juneau School District, which means that we get to go up north and compete against all the other Nordic ski teams across the state, which is very exciting.
Zoe, are you on the high school team?
I am.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's is this your great. First year on it or second year or?
It is my third year.
On the high school team?
On the high school team.
All right. And so do you have have you had a ton of success? Are you amazing skier?
I wouldn't say
you look
so,
to me like a Nordic
really
skier. You look like someone who's like a Nordic skier. I can see you got the sweater going. That's a Nordic ski sweater.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I cross country ski and I've always liked it. I do the classic style. I can never quite figure out the other one. I don't know. So everyone passes me while I'm just going along. But so I love it. But tell me what you love about Nordic skiing versus any other kind of like sport you'd be doing at that time of year.
It's just a calm about it, which I really appreciate. After school, you go there, and even if it's like the most crazy, hectic, confusing workout, you get in this groove and you're like in this mindset and you can kind of let your mind wander. So it really like it puts me in this headspace that I really like.
That's a nice way of thinking about it. I agree with you. I think it's kind of like, you know, the runner's high, they kind of call it, like that endorphin kind of boost that you get it from cross country skiing, maybe even faster. You're using so much of your body when you're cross country skiing, you know, it's immersive that way, you know? Yeah. And Finn, tell me about what's your career been? Is this your third, fourth year?
Yeah, this is my fifth year with the club.
Oh, okay.
So I started in middle school on the middle school team. And I'm a senior in high school now. So this is my fourth year on the high school team.
Do you compete in other sports as well?
I do. I think it's a lot of people transition with Nordic and a running sport. So I run cross country and track as well. There's a lot of crossover.
Yeah.
But I also have a lot of friends who don't run and still really enjoy it.
I would add on, that's one of the things that I really love about cross country skiing is it's a sport that plays well with many other endurance sports, and it's low impact. So
that's what I was going to say.
Yeah. So once you learn it, you know. It's one of those things you really can do for lifelong health and well-being. It's easy on the joints. You know, you're not going at high speed. So if you hit something, it's typically not that painful.
I guess you hit depends. A moose, you know, it'd be bad.
Right, there you go. Right. Certain things you don't want to run into. But it really is one of those things where, and you know, our program is one of those programs that where we really do try to include everyone, whether you are an athlete or you're new to athletics and whether you've skied before or not, we really do try to let people know that we are an all-inclusive program. And we have everyone from elementary students.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah, so we have
enough
our
these high schoolers.
Tried and true Sunday Junior Nordic program that's been going on for decades. I think it might be the longest running Nordic program.
Did you guys do that?
No, but I'm a coach.
Oh, okay. You coach it. Okay, cool. Yes. And did you do the...
I didn't start skiing until middle school.
Okay.
Yeah. Everyone on the team, a lot of people start never skiing before. And we start from really low ability and everyone gets to learn.
Well, that's a good point. You know, I mean, it's great to start when you're really young at any sport or, you know, that can be great. But skiing, Nordic skiing is one of those things that you can pick up the technique and really get it down. And it's something that can be learned even if you haven't been doing it since you were 3 years old.
Absolutely, any age. And, you know, then we also have our middle school program, which even though this year, when it comes to the arrangement of the schools, even though sixth grade is in the elementary school, our program for middle school is sixth through eighth this year. So, and, you know, we have some spots left. That's the other thing I wanted to say, Andy, is that we are filling up fast.
Yeah.
We have some spots left in junior Nordic. We have about 12 spots left in middle school or 15 rather. And then we have about 12 spots left in high school. So if people are interested, they should get on it.
Where do you guys train? Do you have different spots?
Yeah. So the best trails around Juneau will go up to Eagle Crest sometimes. That's a bit of a drive. The campground.
Sometimes it's the only one that's really, you know, functional though, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's higher up, so we get more snow up there.
Yeah.
Montana Creek is a really beautiful ski. And sometimes last year we added on Salmon Creek to the grooming trails in Juneau.
That's cool. Does this kind of transition for you outside of the team to like backcountry skiing and just going on adventures on your own?
Yeah, for sure. My dad is really into backcountry skiing. So I think I'm going to go with him a couple of times this year. We'll see. But I do downhill ski.
We'll see, Dad. Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, I don't know about my ability yet. But I also run. I'm on the cross country and track team. So, you know, all of those sports help me get into the mountains and see the world.
Tell me about, so I'm guessing that you guys do the skate ski style, right? I mean, that's the dominant. Is that it, or
we compete in both?
Mm-hmm. It's half and half.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So do you do both? Do most people do both styles, or do you specialize?
Yeah, no, we absolutely you know, teach both techniques. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, you pull all the Nordic skiers who do both, and they're all going to have their favorite. And it's going to be probably 50-50. Some people really prefer classic skiing, and some people really prefer the skate technique. But when it comes to competitions, which we do encourage lively competition, we think it's healthy, getting people out of their comfort zone. We will do both at races. So we'll have we call it classic skiing, and then we have the skate technique. And
it
then,
is classic, by the way.
It that's, is very
that's
classic.
What I do,
yeah.
So I love classic.
And then typically we also have added in what's called a sprint race, and that will sometimes be a mixed technique, and sometimes they'll pick skate or classic. Oh man, the relay races are fun to watch.
It's a sprint race, but both styles are going at the same time?
Not at the same time, but like leg one will be, it's a relay sprint.
Gotcha.
So leg one will be classic, and then leg two will be skate. And then, I don't know, maybe they'll throw another classic in there. But those are fun to watch. Those are actually quite exciting.
Hey, is there any biathlon stuff going on?
You know, that is a great question. So there has been interest in recent years in biathlon. And the coach that that I co-coached with last year, Jordan Tanguay, she was really trying to get a team together. I don't know how far they got off their feet, but if folks are interested in biathlon, there are opportunities out there for more information here in Juneau, and they should reach out to the Juneau Ski Club.
Biathlon's wild because it has that penalty loop you have to do. It just seems so humiliating. Get stuck on the penalty loop just because you, you watch it much, biathlon?
I watch it some, but I don't know much about it.
Yeah, but I mean, like, if you miss a target or something, I don't even know. I don't even, but
yeah,
it seems cool.
You have to, I mean, you have to ski hard, high heart rate, lay down and get that heart rate down to almost, you know, calm and then pull the trigger and not miss. And if you do, you have to go do a penalty.
Finn, I can see your eyes going like, does it interest you?
Yeah, I did some biathlon. So our high school team one year, we went up and did a camp where we got to shoot at the range in Anchorage. They have a really nice facility.
Are they like air rifles or what are they?
I think they're 22s.
Oh, they're 22s. Yeah. Okay.
And so we got to mess around safely at their biathlon range. And then I went up for a camp in the summer. And
That's cool. Was it cool?
It was.
I mean, it seems really fun.
It's pretty fun.
And it just is a wild, you know, it's a wild sport, skiing around with guns on your back. I don't know.
I mean, right? That's how they had to do it.
It seems Alaskan to me. It seems really Alaskan. Well, cool. Well, it's so fun talking to you guys. Let's just recap.
Yeah, absolutely.
Back to the kind of main message you want people to know about what's going on with the Nordic Sea Team.
Thanks, Andy. Yeah, so it's open. Our Juneau Nordic Youth Program registration is open. Go to, if you just Google Juneau Nordic Ski Club, look at their programs. All of them are listed there. Registration is fast and easy. Again, we welcome all abilities and ages elementary to high school. And we really do try to make it accessible to all. So our fees are noted there and they're on a sliding scale. So, you know, we do a lot of fundraising to make this affordable for folks. And so we try to alleviate all those hurdles.
Right.
And the other programs, the middle school and Junior Nordic start up in January. Our high school program starts on November 2nd and we'll run through February, where we will compete in regionals and state and wrap it up with our big fundraising event on March 2nd, which is Communiski.
And Finn, I didn't get to ask you, what's your favorite part about Nordic skiing?
I really like being able to get outside in the winter in the really dark months. And I love being in the snow and I participate in all the types of skiing and getting out there with your headlamp on and it's gorgeous after school.
Yeah.
That's what makes it for me.
I mean, that's cool that you say you mentioned that. I mean, so you downhill ski and do you snowboard too or
not so much?
Not so much. Yeah, more downhill skiing. Yeah. But to mix in the Nordic skiing, it's just part of what you do with your outdoor activities as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very cool. Well, thanks to all three of you for coming in. I appreciate it. Zoe Finn and Abby McAllister from the Nordic Ski Team. And Abby, how long have you been coaching?
That's a good question. So
That's why I asked it.
I kicked off my coaching with the team in 2011, kind of around the time that we organized the whole thing. And then I took a little bit of a break in there. So, I mean, I don't know, gosh, about 10 years probably.
Yeah, 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. Wow. And is the team, one other thing I wanted to ask, what you mentioned kind of the joining of the school district and stuff, were there two teams and now it's a joined team?
So for high school, even though we had two high schools, we trained as one team.
Okay.
And then when we traveled to other sanctioned competitions within the state. So regionals and state, we competed as two teams there. And so that was really fun because we were two teams. We got to take pretty much everyone on the team to those races. And it's just such a blast to travel and kind of stretch our wings a little bit and compete against some of the best Nordic skiers in the country, frankly.
Right. I mean, that is true. The South Central and the northern part of the state. I mean, the skiing up there is incredible.
It's incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah.
The athletes that come out of that, those regions are really top notch. And so it's fun to
see where we stack Olympians
up.
And
yeah,
all
absolutely.
That. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very cool. Well, you too. I mean, I'm not giving up hope that the Southeast is going to come up with Olympians. It may be that we're looking at them right here.
It's never too late.
Do you ever want to pursue it? Like if you have college things like that, or you want to pursue Nordic skiing? Is it an option?
I don't think I would do it competitively. It's really just that mental space I like. So yeah. I will continue skiing, but maybe not competitively.
All right. That sounds great. Well, thanks to all three of you. Appreciate it. It's the Nordic Ski Team. And thanks so much for talking to us, and get out there and have a great hope for snow. We're all hoping
for snow.
That's all right.
Okay.
Welcome back. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon from KTOO. I'm your host, Andy Klein, and with me now from the USDA Forest Service, it's Laura Buckeit. And Laura, thanks so much for coming in. It's part of our regular feature of talking to the folks at the Forest Service about what's going on. And there's a really cool kind of national thing that's coming through Southeast Alaska that we want to talk about, which is that the U.S. Capitol Christmas tree is from the Tongass this year.
I'm so glad to be here to talk about this and other things. Yes, the Capitol Christmas Tree, an annual event. This is the first time that the tree has come from the Tongass National Forest.
That's amazing. I would not have guessed that. Mm-hmm. With all the beautiful, is it the spruce that's going to go down?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh, yeah.
It is indeed.
With all the amazing Sitka spruce that we have growing throughout Southeast Alaska, famous for guitar making, but... Maybe not for Christmas trees as much.
And it may be the logistics involved, because there certainly is a lot of logistics involved to getting a tree all the way across the country.
Now, this one starts in kind of the Wrangell area. Is that right?
Exactly. It's starting from the Wrangell Ranger District.
And it's going on tour.
It is. So it starts the logistics, of course, have been in play for quite a while in terms of the assessment, the selection of the tree, and then the harvest celebration will be it's coming up soon this month. October 26th will be the start of the celebratory tour in Wrangell, and then there'll be one other stop here in Alaska, and that'll be in Ketchikan.
On October 30th, yes. And from there, it goes to across the country on a whirlwind tour of Oregon and Utah and Colorado and Ohio and Indiana, Maryland, and then finally getting to Washington, D.C. in November.
Yes, by sea and by land.
How do they have to do anything necessarily to kind of preserve it? Do they bind it up? How is it transported around and kept green?
It has been fascinating, the opportunities to, because of the long journey, there's some special research and accommodations being made to keep the tree alive all the way across the country. And my understanding is that there's been work within the school system at Wrangell to do some investigation and research of how to best package up the tree, particularly since it's not going to be cut, it's going to be dug up so that there's a special bladder being designed and wrapped around the roots to sustain it in its long journey.
Well, I did not even guess that would have been what they're doing. It's essentially a gigantic potted plant.
Yes.
They're bringing it across the country, but it's a spruce tree, and it's a big, massive, full-grown spruce tree. Mm-hmm. Do you know about how the size of it or anything? I mean, I don't even know if it's been transplanted yet or anything, but.
It's 74 feet.
Okay. Big tall. Tree.
So you can imagine, right? We think about the trees that we harvest and have in our living rooms, in our homes, or around the city, and think about that magnitude. You know, we have a hard time maybe putting it on top of the roof of our car. Think about the incredible setup. And it's going to be accompanied in its journey by Forest Service employees, both the logistical and civil culture, the tree specialists, but also the educators who will be setting up a booth, setting up informational displays all the way across the country to really showcase the amazing place that the Tongass is.
Wow.
You know, what is unique and special about this area that we call home.
That's cool.
And it'll share it across the country all the
way
to D.C.
Such a cool way to share a part of us with the rest of the country,
And the number of ornaments that were designed and made here in Alaska, all throughout Alaska. The goal was 10,000 ornaments made that would be unique to Alaska. And the state of Alaska surpassed that. There are currently, the latest count was 14,000. And I'm proud to say that over 2,000 came here from Juneau.
Wow, that's so cool. It's such a cool thing. Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk about one other incredibly amazing and meaningful thing that happened, and we can talk about other stuff too, but the rededication of a beautiful totem carved by Amos Wallace back in 1985 that was relocated to the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Just tell me about that.
Sure. The kutia, the totem pole that had been in a few different locations related to the Forest Service in Juneau, was most recently at the district office, the one on Back Loop Road, in the past few years, and then was relocated back at the visitor center. So it is now standing next to the fireplace there at the visitor center. And
wow,
it was done in great ceremony and a great recognition of both the work of the carver and also in recognition of the co-stewardship agreement that has been in place for almost a year now.
I'm good friends with Brian Wallace, who's Amos Wallace's son, and it was an incredibly proud day for him, I know, and incredibly meaningful for him to have his father's work on display in a very public way, maybe one of the most public way we can do that with the Forest Service here in Juneau. And tell me about this agreement that it was celebrating and in recognition of as well.
Absolutely. So it was just about a year ago that the formal agreement was formally signed between the Forest Service and the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. And to recognize a shared stewardship of the Mendenhall Glacier Recreation Area. It's specific to that location and place. And there was an ongoing collaboration and planning for having the cultural ambassadors in place at the visitor center. Which was really successful this past season.
Great. And is going to continue on.
And will continue
in future seasons. Well,
exactly.
I just wanted to note that the Glacier Visitor Center transitioned to winter hours starting October 1st. And in just a less than a minute that we have less, anything else you want to make sure we cover while we're having our monthly talk here?
Well, just to make sure that, you know, people have a chance to get out to see the kutia that is now in place at the visitor center. And yes, the winter hours that have been posted will be for primarily the weekends, Friday and Saturdays, except for this month when the ships are in port. And stay tuned for the hours transitioning and evolving over the course of this winter.
Well, Laura Buckheit with the USDA Forest Service, thanks so much for coming in for our for our regular talk about what's happening with the Forest Service and all the amazing programs. This was a few of the many things on the list of all the great things that are happening and all the interesting things that the Forest Service is doing here. Thanks so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Honored to be here. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. That's going to do it for Juno Afternoon, broadcast live on KTOO 104.3 FM, online at kto.org, and rebroadcast on this station at 7 p.m. Boston Christopher is our producer, and we had help today from Lisa Purvis. And I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. Thanks so much for joining the conversation.